Hi, I'm Philippe Inácio and you listen to F1 Weekly.
There are fewer than 30 men in the world qualified to drive Formula One. A mere half dozen, perhaps, to win. At this moment, I'm inclined to think you're not one of them.
No, you want to.
Keep up the good work, Stephen, and there you have it. There you go.
Hello, this is Desiree for F1Weekly.com. I'm your in-depth correspondent.
Let's go with the qualifying, Steve.
Welcome to F1Weekly.com. My name is Clark Rogers. I'm the host of the program. I'll be joined by Nasser Hamid, my co-host. This is podcast number 834, June 1st, 2020. Nasser?
Thank you, Mr. President. Top of the grid today. The team in Grove is on the stove. Wolfman Jack may spin his final record in 2020. We shall explain. Gladly. Back to you, sir.
Thank you, Nasser. On today's program, Williams, yes indeed, is up for sale. LCH, not happy with white-dominated F1. Can 2020 get any stranger? And could a camping chair really be the safest place to be in 2020? I got more. This week's vintage interview, of course, is part two of Miguel Mansell 2008 interview. Absolutely outstanding. And I just need to remind everybody that we need your contributions to keep this program on the air. Just click on the support F1 Weekly tab. You know you'll want to. Nas, welcome to the studio. How are you?
I'm doing very good, sir. And you mentioned Arnaij, and I am still very thankful to him for his time because he gave me over almost an hour of his time at Laguna Seca where we recorded this interview. And I felt so comfortable that I even asked him some question that I normally would not have asked a driver unless I was feeling very comfortable, and which included his relationship with Nelson Piquet and Peter Waugh. And of course, having watched so many of his battles at 5 a.m, in my excitement, I kept grabbing his hand. So again, my thanks to Il Leone for being very kind. Sir, a major news coming out of Europe last week, and we can say about time for both, but still, possible major shakeup reported in the world of Formula One regarding Williams and Toto Wolff. Do you have anything to say on the Williams situation and your BFF, Claire Williams?
Well, let's put it this way. We all expected this.
Yes, sir. FDR once said, "Only thing we have to fear is fear itself." Well, in Formula One, we now have to fear the disappearance of one of the most iconic names in championship history. Frank Williams, who once operated his Grand Prix team from a public payphone and who would ask journalists to give him a ride to the track as he could not afford to rent a car in his Formula Two days, is now nearing the checkered flag on his days as a team owner. Last Friday, a statement from the team said, and I quote, "The WGPH board is undertaking a review of all the various strategic options available to the company. Options being considered include, but are not limited to, raising new capital for the business, a divestment of a minority stake in WGPH, or a divestment of a major stake in WGPH, including a potential sale of the whole company." End of quote. So they are trying to get rid of the whole kit and caboodle. They've already sold most of their interest in advanced vehicle engineering. I believe their subsidiary was called, which was very profitable. Last season, the team incurred a loss of like £13 million, which is close to like £15-16 million in today's conversion rate, compared to a profit of almost 13 million in 2018. Now, a lot of theories have been put on the YouTube and on the interweb why the team is in a nosedive. I think the, and it's general consensus, the decline of the team started after their split from BMW. Maybe Dr. Mario Tyson put a voodoo on the team for terminating their contract prematurely. When a team that employed Prost, Mansell and Senna take on Kazuki Nakajima as a driver in a package deal with Toyota engines, you know they have no bargaining power. A very favorite quote of one of my ex-bosses, you know, he used love to tell customers, you have no bargaining power. If the team is sold, Claire Williams will get the same treatment as Tony George when Roger Penske bought the IndyCar operation. The Western Union man will knock on the palatial residence, and the message will say, your services are no longer required. The team was built into a powerhouse by Frank Williams and his co-founder and engineer Patrick Head. First win, 1979 British Grand Prix at Silverstone, which I remember vividly listening live on the BBC World Service sports program in back in K-Town. Their first world championship was delivered in 1980 by Aussie mate Alan Jones, a real tough guy and perfect driver for Frank and Patrick Head. The team won nine Constructors' Championships and 114 race wins. Other championship-winning Williams drivers include 1982 Keke Rosberg, 1987 Nelson Piquet, 1992 Nigel Mansell, 1993 Alain Prost, 1996 Damon Hill, 1997 Jacques Villeneuve. Last Grand Prix win for the team, Barcelona 2012. Hard to believe in that race, Pastor Maldonado was faster than Fernando Alonso. Long story short, if the Williams name disappears from Formula One, it will be a very sad day. They will have a lot of company in the graveyard of Grand Prix glory, Maserati, Brabham, Lotus, all championship-winning teams. Race in peace for 2020 at least. I feel sorry for Claire. She may be filing UB40 soon. She may be a 1 in 100, but definitely not 1 in 10. Sir, will you miss Williams Grand Prix Racing if the name changes to Latifi Grand Prix Racing or Stroll second Grand Prix team?
Yeah, it's a sad day. I mean, we've seen these days come. Matra and other great powerhouses that come and go. Life is tough, but we have to take it in the chin, Ness.
That is very true. Now, the other big news coming out of Europa last week was the Mercedes situation and how long will the star of Stuttgart shine in Formula One. Actually, it was on Thursday of last week, two German publications, Auto Bild and Motorsport Total, reported that Toto Wolff, and this has been rumored now for a while now, will resign as head of Mercedes AMG F1 team at the end of the 2020 season, but may continue in an advisory role, sort of like Niki Lauda's situation. With the appointment of Mercedes man Moers as the new CEO of Aston Martin, where Mercedes' parent company Daimler-Benz has a 5% stake and also supply engines for production cars. I'm not sure if they are supplying engines for all models or just one or two. Wheels are definitely in motion in Stuttgart to realign the F1 program. Their new CEO for Daimler-Benz AG, AG stands for Aktin Gesellschaft, is Mr. Ola Källenius. He is from Sweden, and he used to be head of Mercedes High Performance Division, which is based in Brixworth and supply F1 racing engines. And this operation was previously known as Ilmor, the company started by Mario Illen and the late Paul Morgan. Several scenarios are being played out. One is Mercedes will pull out of F1 as an entrant, but will continue with the engine program. The other is team will be sold to Toto and Lawrence Stroll. Toto already owns 30% of the team and recently invested a large amount in Aston Martin car company. There are suggestions Mercedes will increase their ownership in Aston Martin and use that brand against Ferrari to push sales to people who are not James Bond. With more than one F1 team almost done blowed up financially courtesy of coronavirus, it is a buyer's market. More like billionaire buyer's market, especially those who have sons who could be world champions if there were no Lewis, Leclerc, Max and the like on the grid. From Russia with love for Formula One is Nikita Mazepin. His Pepito is basically Stroll of Siberia and owns Uralchem, a large fertilizer company. He was outbid by Stroll to acquire Force India. He may now get his chance to own his team and put Nikita in F1 orbit, who has been racing in F2. Lawrence Stroll will do, I think, what he can to make his son race and championship-winning driver. With the current Mercedes-like package, it can be done if he offers a free ride to his son's teammate with the understanding and agreement that they are Rubinho and Bottas of the team. This was the trick employed to help Lance dominate the 2016 European F3 Championship, and I say this based on reports from that time frame as that he had also bought the Prema Racing team. So, you know, money can take you to a lot of places. But to take you to the top of the podium step is just going to require some machismo-ness. As always, there are two sides to every story. As expected, Mercedes has responded to these reports as hogwash, or as they say in Deutschland, Schweinwash. Mercedes, in or out, we will find out in due course of time. Once we get going in July in Austria, it will be their competition squealing like a pig. At least that's what I think at this stage. What say you, sir?
Well, squealing like a pig is not very Austria-esque, but they do have mountains, and they do have guitar players, so you never know. But you know what? 2020 is turning out to be such a bizarro world year. I mean, we've had everything thrown at us. It's some kind of weird test to see if we can handle it. I personally can't handle it, and I'm freaking out. But, yeah, sure. I believe everything now. Toto is going to resign. I believe it all.
And Alonso will win the world championship.
How did you know?
Well, he's such a machismo man that he can win in a HRT.
Beautiful. Loved HRT.
No, I'm sorry. I take that back. He can win in the Mercedes.
Bravo.
Okay, sir. Now, good news for you. I was genuinely pleased to read this. Renault in the race. Le Chat is out of the bag. Good news for Chase and charming host. The yellow submarine will surface in F1 next season. The Enstone-based team escaped the chop-chop when 2 million euro cost-cutting measures were announced last week by interim CEO, Mademoiselle Clotilde Delbos, I believe that's the name. She said, and I quote, sorry, I don't have the French accent, but she said, the new regulations, new cap in term of investments, because we had less investment than some of our competitors who are spending a lot of money. So F1, we are here, and we stay in Formula One. End of quote. Renault is cutting 15,000 jobs worldwide. 4,600 in France. Partner Nissan is closing its plant in Barcelona, which employs about 3,000 people. The UK plant in Sunderland will continue. I say, ooh la la. Clotilde may be your new Carmen from Bizet. What say you, monsieur?
Je suis vraiment heureux d'être content. I'm happy. I mean, hey, I know everybody's suffering, and when you're laying off 15,000 people, it's hard to justify a Formula One team. But in the end, it still helps to sell cars.
Yes, and I think, you know, of that since the budget is coming down to 150 million, I think from the TV revenue, the money that they get, some sponsorship, their cost maybe, you know, might be cut down to less than 100 million. And if you are doing $70-80 million, 20 Formula One races around the world, that is not a bad expense for a multi-billionaire global company. Okay, sir, moving on to, I would say, some sad news or disappointing. No Dutch treat this year. Everything was ready for the first Dutch Grand Prix since 1985 when Niki Lauda won his final race over Alain Prost. There was a new banking and there was a young local boy who wandered very far in Formula One. He was ready. But race director Jan Lammers, who once served as a T-boy at the same circuit, said no fans, no race. He went on to say they want to celebrate the Grand Prix event with their fans who have been very supportive. Apparently all race tickets were sold within a few hours when they were initially offered. He added, I quote, I have waited 35 years for the Dutch Grand Prix. I can wait another year. End of quote. Would you have anything to say on this one, sir? I know your wife is from Den Haag.
Correct. Dutch wife. And the host is always challenged by the Dutch wife. But anyway, we can wait another year. I was disappointed that we didn't have a Dutch Grand Prix this year. But one more year, and I think 2021 should be not as ridiculous as 2020.
Man, you are right. 2020 is a very, very strange season. First time I'm hearing that there is somebody in this world who can challenge you.
Bravo.
Okay, sir, moving on to more delicious things. The FIHA Grand Prix organizers are still hopeful they can stage their inaugural race in Hanoi this year and are working with Chase Carey and Liberty Media for a new date. On the other hand, the Singapore girl is saying she will only go out on their scheduled date, September 20th, or we can still be friends. Little does she know, Chase is looking for greenbacks, not honeybacks. As LCH said, cash is king. $50 queen is available on every street as per Dire Straits. Any thoughts on, are you going to miss a Singapore Grand Prix, by the way?
I love the Singapore Grand Prix, don't you?
Absolutely not. I know it's an exotic location. I'm told the food is very good and very cheap and it's extremely humid. But it's very impressive setting, nothing against the place or the people. But man, do we need a street race for cars that have close to 1,000 horsepower? Or should I say, do we need another street race?
It's called the Mighty Dollar, Nasser.
Absolutely, sir. Absolutely. And I cannot wait. Apparently, they are spending a lot of money to build a track that will pretty much blow away everybody. I've seen some like artist rendering. It is out of this world. And I'm not kidding you. So let's see when we have the Saudi Arabian Grand Prix, what they bring to the table. But sir, some good news and some bad news. In other news items, I read that the Monza Grand Prix contract has been extended one more year, so it will go till 2025. Hopefully, you and I will be around to watch that. But the bad news is, things are getting better everywhere. Flights are operating even in Italy and Spain. But looks like the Italian Grand Prix at Parco Monza will be no spectators, and that was very disappointing to me because I was planning a trip to Europe in March, and of course it could not happen. And then I was thinking, maybe I can go, if I have to do a quick dash just to go and attend the Italian Grand Prix at my all-time favorite circuit. But if there are no spectators, then SOL for me. And what's really hurting is apparently U.S. Grand Prix may not even take place, and if it takes place, no cowboys and no homies allowed. So that's going to be pretty sad for getting some Formula One fix. But I am thinking, if Canadian Grand Prix does not take place, which I don't think it will now, U.S. Grand Prix does not take place, then Mexico is not too far from Tampa, Florida. Maybe I can make a run there at least, get a day or two off from work and make a quick dash. Because, being in the F1 paddock area in the media room, Mr. Rogers, and you've been there, to be able to chit-chat a little bit with all sorts of people, technical people, management people, PR people, a few drivers. And there are always, people who are in racing a few years ago. Damon Hill is always there, and once I even saw Adrian Sutil. So we can hopefully get some interviews done. But I seriously, seriously need a racing fix. And I'm sure so do a lot of other people. Do you have any update on if the U.S. Grand Prix will take place or not?
It will not take place, but I'm glad you brought up the Mexican Grand Prix, because I know why you bring that up. Just so I could say, enjoy the in-flight burrito.
Oh, absolutely. And if I go business class, if you give me an upgrade, I might even get the whole enchilada.
Wow. And an Ortega burger.
Yeah, with sour cream, which is so delicious.
Absolutely.
And what else is going on? Apparently, there is the IndyCar season is starting this week in Texas at the Texas Motor Speedway, if I'm not mistaken, sir. And I'm surprised we've gone so far. You have not said a thing about your favorite series.
That's because it's too much. There's too many races that are in the week, and half of them I can't get because it's on Fox Sports 1. I don't get Fox Sports 1.
Okay, and you know, last week we talked about British Grand Prix going mushy peas. Well, good news is that we're going to have kidney pudding, not mushy peas. Agreement has been worked out, and the 14-day quarantine period will be waived for the Formula One personnel. So we will have two Formula One Grand Prix races. It'll be like a GP2 weekend at Silverstone in July. So I'm really, really happy. Of course, no spectators, but I'm very excited that we're going to have, you know what they're trying to do, which I like it, because they're trying to cram 8 races in Europe by the end of September. So if something goes wrong, if this pandemic comes back again or whatever, some new issue comes up, we can at least have a confirmed world champion for this year, albeit with 8 races. And I still think, I have a feeling there'll be more than 8 races, but I still think if it's 8 races, it will give a very, very good chance to Max Verstappen to become the youngest world champion. What say you?
It's not going to happen. And the reason is Mercedes is so dominant. That's why they are totally against the reverse grid qualifying. Simply because they're afraid that the reverse grid will show how dominant the Mercedes is, and everybody will go into a deep depression.
As if they don't know already. Okay, anything else you would like to discuss? You know, I saw some interesting news item. You know, the DTM series is pretty much on its deathbed because Mercedes pulled out a few years ago. Audi gave them their notice. And so it's only BMW left. Now there is some reports because they were trying to align with the same rules and regulations, technical specifications of the cars as the Japanese Super GT series, which is very popular in Japan. So now there are some reports that maybe Honda or Toyota or Nissan may join DTM and save the series. But we'll see how it works out. And sir, finally, we come to our Sony segment. What's in your Walkman? Today we share what Sebastian Vettel has been listening during the corona and his own F1 pandemic. Take it away, Miss Joan Armour Trading. Folks, thank you for listening.
I'm thinking more and more of what we had before.
Keep up the good work, Nass. And now, part two of the killer interview.
You know, regarding the second part, I asked him towards the end of the interview of all the things he has done in battle, you know, epic battles against all the great drivers, what was the thing, what achievement that he's most proud of? Very, very interesting what he has to say.
Excellent. Keep and I love that story. NASA. Always an outstanding job with your Motorsports Mondial and the extra goodie bag at the end. So we'll have a little Nigel, and then we'll come back with emails and the wrap-up. We'll be back.
1989 Rio, first race with Ferrari. You win first time out, and you are then Il Leone with the Tifosis. What was the atmosphere working in an Italian team compared to an English team?
Magical. The Italian and Ferrari were just starting to climb up the ladder again, and it was wonderful to be part of their organization, and to win three races for them with the time I had with them there was fantastic. I enjoyed every minute. It was a great challenge. It was very a political team when I was there, and then shortly after I left and Prost left, you know, the complete rejuvenation of Ferrari came with Michael Schumacher and certain personnel, and I think it's wonderful the success Ferrari have had, and so richly and well deserved. And for me, I still think, you know, Williams, Ferrari, you know, Ferrari for me has still got the edge to be the best team.
Now, I read somewhere that you were the last driver personally selected by Enzo Ferrari. Yes. Did you meet him? Did you get to know him?
I had dinners with him and was signed by him. I was the last driver to be signed. And again, I felt very privileged because, you know, meeting the great man and seeing how he operates. And it was a respect that he had for everybody, but more so everybody had for him. You know, if he just started to move, everyone would be quiet instantly in case he wanted to say something. And it was a magical time at Ferrari.
Now, let me tell you, I've been following motor racing since 1973. The greatest motor racing pass, strictly in my opinion, that I would love to watch on YouTube, 1990 Mexico. Tell me about that, please.
Yeah, with Gerhard Berger. It was one of those maneuvers. A number of laps before, Gerhard locked up coming in down the straight and almost punted me off. I had to go left. The corner went right, so he didn't hit me. And he overtook me, what I feel, in a bad way, not in a good way. So I thought, well, I'm not going to let you get away with that. And, of course, I sort of picked the car up and drove it harder and harder. And I thought, well, going into the Peralta, I'm just not going to lift. I'm going to overtake you on the outside. And I overtook him on the outside, and it was literally one of those maneuvers which is very dangerous. It's a shit or bust maneuver, because if it comes off, you're a hero, and if it doesn't, you could kill yourself. And I've done a couple of those over the years, and it was a magical maneuver, and I know it impressed a number of people, because although I came second in the race, I was clapped by the whole teams in the pit lane when I came in, because they really thought it was the most amazing maneuver. So it was neat.
Did Berger have to say? I'll tell you, I was watching it with a friend of mine, and they're on TV live. It was showing Gerhard Berger in car camera, and he's approaching. You come on the outside, and you're gone. And we just looked at each other, speechless.
He couldn't believe it either. He was in shock that someone could be that stupid to try and do that.
How does that stack up for you against passing Senna and Hungaroring?
Yeah, they're both very technical, very ballsy moves. The Hungarian, I boxed Ayrton in Hungary, and that was a great positioning. It was like a chess game, and that was with Ayrton to outfox him. And to win that race was very special.
1992, your championship year, and again a tremendous battle between you and Senna in the streets of Monte Carlo. Do you think there was a way to pass him if there was another lap or two left?
Probably, if I'd have lost my front nose cone, and you know, we could have had an accident. I mean, we were fighting tooth and nail, and Ayrton was like a bus in front. He was moving left, he was moving right, moving left again. Under the new rules now, he would have been black flagged. So, you know, technically I can look back and say, I should have been given that race. But it led for a lot of excitement. It was very dangerous. It was very frustrating, because I had to concentrate on not having an accident at every corner, because it was blocking all the time. But it was great motorsport. It was great motor racing. It was very exciting, and but also just a little bit disappointing because I'd like to have won Monaco.
Question: Canada, when you were waving to the people on the last lap, and you know, cars stopped. What really happened there? I've heard that system shut it down, or you killed the switch. What's the truth?
The actual truth is that the old semi-automatic gearbox failed and put the car into neutral, and I just couldn't get a gear, and it was a great disappointment and great shame, and you know, what can you say? And then you have certain minorities of the press make up these stories that, you know, you knock the ignition switch off, and really it's so pathetic, it's unbelievable, other than the fact some people actually believe it. So it was devastating because it was the most perfect race. We had a huge lead, and I was actually taking it easy on the slowdown lap, and then you know, fate strikes, just like the tire exploding, which was a great visible thing in 86, which people will see, God, the tire exploded. With an electrical failure, you can't see anything. The engine just stops. So that's what happened.
Now, when you won the championship, you came to the U.S. Was money the only main reason that you left Williams and Formula One to come here?
No, I mean, the thing is when you win the world championship, you really expect to be given the opportunity to defend it in the manner that you won it. And, you know, there's no secret that Prost wanted me out of the team. And, you know, they offered me half the salary to stay there for the following year. And so that's as good as saying, well, you know, we don't want you there. When you're world champion, you've got to make the opportunities. I was offered a good deal to come to America, a new adventure, a new beginning. We lived in America at the time as well. And so, you know, destiny would have it that when one door closed, another one opened, and then it was like a fairy tale. We won the championship back to back. I'm the only person in the history of auto racing that held two championships simultaneously across the Atlantic. Only four people have achieved it, which is in no particular order: Emerson Fittipaldi, Mario Andretti, myself, and Jacques Villeneuve. So, you know, it's a special bit of history.
Talking of Alain Prost, I was reading an interview in Motorsports with Damon Hill, and he said that he did not learn a thing from Alain Prost, but he learned from Senna, with whom he only had three races. How was your experience with Prost as a teammate at Ferrari?
Alain is a very clever man, is very political. He works very much with the sponsors and the officials, and whatever he can do to get the advantage out of the car, he's very good at that. He's a very good driver, but he's a driver, he's not a racer. And so he used every means he can, and obviously, you know, I was privileged or lucky or unlucky to drive with three world champions, with Keke Rosberg, Alain Prost, and obviously Nelson Piquet. For me, the best world champion I drove from was Keke Rosberg. I learned more from Keke Rosberg because he was a complete racer, Keke, and he was a thoroughbred man. He was a great human being. He drove the car 10 tenths, and he was, for me, a real honest race car driver.
You won your first ever IndyCar race, and was that a surprise to you? And how did you find the competition, depth of competition in IndyCar racing in 1993 as opposed to Formula One?
In some ways, it was a lot harder in IndyCar because at that time there was always 6 to 8 drivers that could win the races. There was a lot more level of playing field. The tracks were tougher. It was a challenge learning the new ways. It was a challenge with driving for 30 odd years clockwise circuits to then come over and drive anti-clockwise circuits. The ovals were an enormous challenge, and obviously I found out at my first attempt how dangerous they were. 148 stitches in my back with a crash at Phoenix. But I enjoyed it, and you know, it's something to look back and reflect on, and feel very proud that I conquered America at the first attempt. And I still believe to qualify in pole position and win the first race has never been done since.
What is the key to going fast on an oval compared to road courses?
Close your eyes and hope. It's you need a very good team to set the car up. You need a good team to set the car up to put you in the window that you're in the ballpark, and then you need to be very patient in what I call perfecting the car, tickling the car, tweaking the car, and getting the balance as close as you possibly can to neutral to understeer. Any oversteer on an oval, it can bite you really hard. And you have to be patient. You have to get the staggers and the tires right. You have to get the cross weight right. There are so many things that you have to do. And you really need a fantastic team that understands oval racing to help you do that.
Mario Andretti was your teammate at Newman Haas, and he was recently quoted as saying that if Ronnie Peterson was his best teammate, he would put you on the other end of the scale. How would you respond to that?
Everyone has their opinion. I think my response to that is Mario, I think, is a very good person. He's a great world champion. He's done fantastic things for motorsport. I'm a father. I have two sons. I think the timing of me coming to Newman Haas was the timing when Michael went to McLaren in Formula One. And as we all know, Michael had a terrible time and experience in Formula One. Mario, obviously, is his father. I was having a great time in IndyCar, and I know it didn't go down well with Mario. I came over and won races, won the championship, and I know it was a tough time for him, but I think it's a shame that he took it out on me rather than actually understanding why he wasn't very happy with things.
Looking back at your career, your most memorable race moments, what do you really cherish from your racing career, not just Grand Prix?
I think the biggest thing I cherish is the fact that I came from nothing and I made a young boy's dream come true, which was mine, to stand momentarily on the top of the world on both sides of the Atlantic, win a lot of races, and still be here to talk to you today. Because in the 70s and 80s, a lot of our drivers were being killed all the time. Formula One in the late 70s, mid 70s, and obviously early 80s, a lot of people died. And I remember in 1980, 81, and 82 was horrendous years. And so to be here today, I look back with great thanks that we achieved some special things and some special memories. And as Gerhard Berger says, at the end of the day, when we're all gone, it's only the history books that's going to tell the story, and perhaps I've written a little bit of history where perhaps we'll be remembered.
You know, you made a comment, came from nothing. Where did you get so much determination that you had? I mean, I cannot even think of a guy succeeding in anything with all the obstacles you had to face. And I'm not saying this just because I'm sitting here. I'm going to say this to all my friends.
I couldn't afford to fail, and I am stubborn, but I had this inner self-belief that all I wanted was equal equipment. If I was given equal equipment and I couldn't win, then I'd walk away tomorrow. I knew if I was given equal equipment, I could win. Being teammates with three different world champions and, three and four world championships, three times Nelson, four times Alan, and obviously Keke. I knew what you needed to actually achieve to win. And you have to be incredibly selfish. You have to have the team working for you, because in the 70s and 80s, the reliability of a Formula One car was not there. If you were outright number one driver, you probably, stats-wise, would finish 30% more races. If you finish 30% more races, you got a chance of winning the World Championship. If you're a number two driver, before you start the season, you might be able to win a race, but you're never going to win a world championship. And so, I learned an awful lot, and that's why I retired in 1990, because I was not being afforded the opportunity to go for world titles.
Your thoughts on what happened at McLaren between Alonso and Hamilton? And talking of Hamilton, do you think he's a real deal?
We'll see this year. I think it's too early to tell. I mean, you have to be in Formula One a number of years before you see what kind of situation you have. I think Kovalainen will keep Lewis very honest this year. Kovalainen's a very quick driver. I predict there's going to be problems with McLaren again this year. and I think it's going to be very interesting. And my my favourites is, I still think Ferrari are going to be good. I think Williams are coming on strong. I think Nico Rosberg's doing a fabulous job. It's good to see Red Bull. It's great to see BMW doing better. And I just hope there's a lot of cars within a second or so this year, so the competition is closer.
You know, when the first hint of trouble came between the two drivers, Alonso and Hamilton, and he was accusing of favoritism because Hamilton is British and so is the team, if you were Alonso's manager, what would you guide or advise him at that stage?
You sometimes just have to keep your head down and do the job. But you know, Alonso is a great world champion. Is a very quick, very talented driver, and you know, only he knows what contract he had with McLaren. But you know, I honestly feel that the whole situation was handled badly, and I think if McLaren look back at, you know, last year, they'll probably behind closed doors, that is, admit that they did a whole number of things wrong, and I think the whole PR exercise between their two drivers at times was pretty appalling.
What about the $100 million fine? You think that's excessive?
I think they're very lucky to still be racing. You know, no one gets fined like that if there isn't absolute proof. And I think if it wasn't for Bernie Ecclestone, they were going to be banned for this year as well. I mean, you know, to get caught with so many documents from, you know, Ferrari, I mean, what can you say?
Oh, you know, but Bernie Ecclestone, the Formula One has really become so big as it is right now. How do you look at circuits moving away from Europe, going to places like India soon, South Korea, Bahrain, places where they do not have a rich heritage of motor racing?
I don't think that matters, as long as you still have a good balance of heritage of races. To take the Formula One on a world basis is just fantastic, and everybody in Formula One, and especially Mr. Ecclestone, should be, you know, complimented, because he's made Formula One what it is today, and is truly a global, incredible machine.
You've lived here and raced in the United States with a lot of success. What will it take for Formula One to have a real strong foothold in the U.S.?
I think Formula One needs to get a little bit leveler playing field, and they need to repair some of the bridges they've burnt. And obviously the terrible race they had here a number of years ago, I think in another couple of years, if they come over here and put on some sensational races and look after the sporting fans, the fans here in America will embrace it like all the other fans worldwide.
Your favorite track on Grand Prix circuit?
I mean, I have several. All the ones I win at are my favorite. But, I mean, obviously, my home track, the British Grand Prix. Winning three on a row in 85, 86, 87, doing the triple was very special. Two at Brands Hatch and then the one at Silverstone. But the most special circuit in the world for me was the old Österreichring. When we used to climb up, it was over 4 miles long, and the Bosch curve, and some unbelievable corners which were very ballsy.
What about everybody's favourite, Spa-Francorchamps?
Well, Spa is probably very close, yeah, absolutely, to the old Österreichring. But for me, the Österreichring just had it, but Spa's very close second, yeah.
How soon or how long before we see the Mansell name back in Formula One or IndyCars?
No idea. We're on this journey, as Paul Newman said to me years ago, come and have an adventure. Well, in 2008, we're having an adventure with the Walker Racing team, and we'll see where it takes us.
Okay, finally, how about a message for our listeners? And we have quite a few listeners in the UK, so if you have any message for countrymen.
Yeah, I mean, please come and say hello and support us. We're here at Laguna Seca in May. We're looking forward to having a fun, challenging time, and I'd just like to congratulate all the racing fans for all the support they give racing in America, because I think motor racing fans are very knowledgeable, and they know how to behave, and it's just a joy to come and race in America.
Thank you very much.
And that's it, Nass. Keep up the good work again. I want to thank everybody who listens. We'll talk to you next week.
Thank you. Bye-bye.